And once the, so I guess once the people came from the south, from Mexico, into the northern area, and they came, they encountered the pueblos, and there was already some type of something similar to a sequía, no, or irrigation here.
Well, they had some irrigation, but not the complex system that was created by the acequias, you know. In some parts of the southwest, like in the Phoenix area, archaeologists have uncovered, and in Casas Grandes, they have uncovered some big irrigation systems. But here, mostly what they were growing were along the alluvial plains and the arroyos, but they were not diverting the water from the rivers away. The acequias did, you know. And that's the first order of business that Oñate and his men did when they got to Oqueoguingue. And they settled there on the confluence of the Chama and the Rio Grande in what today we know as Chamita. It's that Oñate and his advanced group of men arrived there on July 11th. Well, they started digging the first acequia on August 11th, and they were done in about a week. By the time the rest of the group arrived there on August 18th, they had completed the acequia. And then they started working on the church on the 18th of August, and they were completed by September the 8th, because without our water, they couldn't have survived, they couldn't have planted the following year. And they couldn't have built the acequia or their houses, you know. And that's one thing that people don't realize, you know. A lot of people think that the first thing built by the settlers were the churches. Well, they couldn't have built churches if there wouldn't have been water. There's an entry on Wikipedia about the area here in Dixon, you know, which mentions that acequias were not constructed here until the beginning of the 19th century, in early 1800s. Well, that's totally false. I don't know who put that entry there, but that's impossible. The village here was, or the land grant was given in 1725, on September 20th. And the first order of business, according to the laws of the Indies or any of the other ordinances that were promulgated by the Spanish crown, where that first thing you had to do was do the acequia, and it's proven by what Oñate did there in San Juan. Then you had to start work clearing the land to plant. You also had to plant trees. The first thing you had to do was plant trees, you know, because they wanted to, they were establishing settlements for survival, and they were agricultural settlements, so there were a lot of people, of course, that were looking for gold and silver, but the only way they could have survived was if there was food. So, you know, and that also changed the diet of the Tehuas that were living here, because they, with all this introduction of the new foods that they had been unfamiliar with, you know, including bigger ears of corn that they brought from northern Mexico and Chile. Those were all also incorporated by the native people from here, as well as the kitchen gardens or the huertas that were also introduced by the settlers. They were totally different of how they were doing, because at that time, most of the native also were used to foraging for a lot of their foods or hunting. They had no domestic animals. You know, the turkey was probably the only one, and I don't know if it was even domesticated at that time in 1598 here or not, you know, but they, with the introduction of the, they also caused some damage to the environment, because when you have a lot of animals, of course, they'll be eating all the weeds and grasses and everything, you know. So it was an encounter that forever changed the landscape of northern New Mexico and changed the diets of both people. You know, I'm sure that the settlers that came up had trouble also adjusting to some of the foods that the native people were eating here, the same as the native people were totally unaccustomed like to wheat. But once they became accustomed to it, and they also introduced the horno, or where they bake bread, you know, and there's probably more hornos now in some of the Indian pueblos and in some of the Indo-Hispano villages. So it was this cross-pollination from one culture to the other that has developed over 400 years. And now, if you go to Pueblo Fiesta, you know, or any ceremonial event, and you go eat in their houses, well, it's the same food that we eat here. There might be a little bit difference in technique how some things are prepared, but it's basically the same food. And again, it's a combination of foods from all over the globe. You know, it's not only native ingredients, but ingredients from other parts of the world, you know. And of course, they were already eating what we call the quelites, you know, and purslane, verdolagas. They were probably also introduced from the Mediterranean area, but it seems that they've been here forever. So nowadays, it's, unless you dedicate yourself to study that, like I've been doing for a long time, you know, the majority of the people have no clue where these different crops originated, because for most, they originate at the store. They're there. They have no idea how they're grown. They have no idea how to plant them. Now they have no idea even how to cook them, because everything is coming prepared. And the same as working the land, you know, people have no idea about the acequias. You know, I'm always getting into hassles with my neighbors or some other Anglo community that think that the acequias, that the banks of the acequias have always been covered with willows, with Chinese elms, with the Russian olives. Well, those are all invasive species. The willows are not invasive species, they're natural from native from here. But the Chinese elms, they were introduced in the 1930s. The Russian olives, they've been around only for about 30 years. When I was growing up, I don't remember ever seeing a Russian olive. And the banks of the Aseca at that time were completely level, completely clean, so that the mayordomo and the people could walk along the banks, because the banks of the acequias were the roads of the community. You got from one village to the other by following along the banks of the community. My uncle, who used to live nearby, he always used to say that when he was growing up, he could go from here to what today's Dixon, that was actually La Plaza del Embudo, and all the way up to Cañoncito, just by following the banks of the acequia, where one acequia ended, another began, where that other acequia ended, there was another acequia on both sides of the river, you know. Then another thing that people don't realize is that the acequias, each individual acequia is like a terrace. And the way they were set up or developed, that they started from where like here in the Rio Embudo, where it empties into the Rio Grande, it started from the bottom and went up as population grew and expanded and more land was needed. Different acequias were carved out of the available land. But once an acequia is carved, you cannot go and change it and say, well, I'm going to add more land above, or because it's, you know, they were excellent engineers of people who did these acequias, because they went as far into the base of the mountain to be able to carve the acequia. So it created two different types of landscape. The irrigated landscape, which is below the acequia, and then the landscape above the acequia. And that was where people usually built their houses, what it's called the solar. And then where people grazed their animals were called the dehesas. And then there are the montes, where people would go for firewood or to harvest piñon, and then up in the Sierra, you know, they had all were separate ecological niches where people knew exactly where they could harvest and what time of the year, or what they, how they were used in terms of betterment for the community, you know. And those are things that we have forgotten. So now people are building houses everywhere, you know, especially I've seen throughout northern New Mexico that people are building in the most fertile places, which are called La Joyas. A Joya is a jewel. So people before would never build anything on La Joyas because they were the most fertile places. That's where usually where they would grow their kitchen gardens, their huertas de chile or milpas. You know, the way I see it, and just by observation and talking to people, is that the acequia goes up, like I said, right along the base of the mountain, or the there might be a llano for grazing. And then below the acequia were what were called the altitos, you know, the higher elevated pieces of land, and that's usually where people plant their trees because they're less susceptible to frost. And that would be one terrace, and another terrace would be the Joya. And then below the Joya came the Vega. And then right by the river would be the Cienega or the marshlands. You know, the Vegas could also be planted, but were usually used more for domestic animals. And then the Joya itself could be broken up into Melgas. That's also a concept from the Middle East, you know, or comes from the word mielga, and it actually meant like alfalfa. The word alfalfa itself is it's an Arab word for forage. And then the melgas were broken up into beds, or what were in Spanish are called the eras. And everybody within the land grant had access to good land and bad land, but also had access to the river and all the way up to the mountain, because the commons could be used by everybody. They didn't belong to one particular person. So anybody that had land, the suertes were the long strips of land, you know, and they were on average about 13 acres. They were 200 varas wide by 400 varas long. That was the suerte, and the suerte came from the word lottery, because when the settlement was made and the land was allocated, it was allocated based on the suertes or on the lottery system, starting from the center of the plaza and to both sides of the land grant. So, you know, that is a lot of the information that I find that people have no clue and no idea about the land. So for that reason, they end up building houses right by the arroyos or right by the rivers. You know, in the olden times, people would never build by the river or right very close at the edge of the arroyo also, you know, because just by common sense tells you that you get a flood and your house would be flooded. And nowadays, you have people that are supposedly more astute and more educated with a PhD, and they might have a PhD in ecology or biology or whatever, and they still make the same mistake of building these houses in places that should not be built. Houses should be built in the worst land, so that you don't take away from the agricultural land. Like where I built my house here was on a really bad slope. I had to backfill to be able to build it, because I didn't want to take a lot of the cultivated land for the house. So that's why I had to build terraces, and there were also terraces here. So one of the things that I've realized is that the landscape has a memory, and if there were terraces or acequias that had been constructed 100, 200 years ago, or, you know, once you learn to read the landscape, you find where man had already kind of manipulated the landscape for its survival. You know, terraces are another thing that were very common in the past year. Now, most of the terraces are also disappearing, and they disappeared like starting like in the 1950s when the tractors were introduced, that they were, people started buying very big tractors from Colorado because the landscape is totally different over there. They have big ranches there, big farms, hundreds of acres. Here you have 2 acres, 3 acres, 5 acres, maybe 10 acres. And when you have one of those big tractors, they couldn't turn around in the small terraces, so they broke down the terraces. And that also caused erosion, and also a lot of the topsoil ended up just washing away and into the rivers.
So would you say that a lot of the changes really began in the 50s, or?
I would say that a lot of the changes probably started to take place after Los Alamos. And then, in the 50s, you know, also, but more so, I would say, in the last 30 years, you know, I think a lot of the changes to the landscape have been in the past 30 years, because a lot more housing has been developed, both by local people that have remained here, and the land has been subdivided into smaller pieces, so they end up putting mobile homes, and then also people from the outside coming and buying land, and they have no idea of the history of the landscape here. They come with a model maybe from the East Coast or the West Coast that's totally different from New Mexico. And, you know, I noticed that a lot of the people that are moving in here now, they want to build their houses right below the acequia or by the river because they like the sound of water. But they don't realize that, like last summer that we had the floods, a lot of the people that had built their houses right below the acequia were in a panic because they were afraid that the acequia would break and their houses would be destroyed, you know. And so I think those are a lot of the changes, you know. Also, a lot less people are farming the land than they were before. What I'm seeing here in this community and in other areas is that we're getting a lot of retirees, older people, that I have no clue why they want to buy a acequia property, except that they can afford it and buy it and then turn around and sell it for a huge profit. But they're not here. They're not part of the community. They come in for 6 months, maybe 8 months, and then they, like the swallows, you know, they disappear during the winter. And though they might be the ones that attend all the conferences on organic farming and sustainable agriculture, they're not involved in doing any of that. You know, but once they buy the land and it remains fallow, in a couple of years, in 5 years, it's going to be full of shiny salm seedlings. And they don't want to cut them because they don't believe in cutting anything. So that land that took so long for my ancestors to really develop and turn into agricultural land is going back to the wild. But not the way it was before with pinon or juniper, but nothing but invasive species. You know, the shiny salms consume huge amounts of water. I've read that they consume about 200 gallons of water a day. And we've got some shiny salms along the banks of our acequia. And before the water is even running in the acequia, and when you cut those shiny salms down, right from the center of the tree, the water spouts out like if you had turned on a water hose. So you can imagine how much water those trees are consuming. And when we have a drought, everybody's complaining that there's not enough water. Well, that's one of the reasons we don't have enough water, because all these trees are taking up all the water. But people don't want to cut them. They say, well, that's a way that I've seen the acequia since I moved here. Yeah, but Some of them have been here only 10 years, others maybe 5 years, at the most 30 years. That's nothing. You know, the landscape had already started to change. But when I was growing up, I remember the acequias were very different from what they are now, you know. Now we're also having a lot of mayordomos and a lot of commissioners on the acequia that have no clue what they're doing there, except that they bought land and they either volunteer or got appointed to be on the commission. But they don't know the community. They don't know the acequia in itself. You know, a mayordomo and a commissioner should know the acequia from the beginning in the presa to the last desagüe, like you know the palm of your hand. You have to know every arroyo that runs into the acequia, everything. You know, you have to know where all the beaver dens are, where the muskrats are, or else you're not going to be able to do a very good job, you know. And then people are reluctant that if there's, like with the easements, you know, that people are blocking the easements to the acequias, the commissioners and the mayordomos are reluctant to take these people to court to force them to open up the easements because they have to. You cannot put a fence across an acequia. That's against the state law also, you know. You cannot keep anybody away from the easements of the acequias. And according to state law, the acequias have easements wide enough so that you can do the job that needs to be done. Some acequias have said, well, we need 10 feet of easement from the middle of the acequia to each side, which makes it about 20 feet, others 15, depending on the size of the acequia. But these easements go way back, you know, on the Siete Partidas of 1156 or something like that. You know, King Alfonso the Wise mentions there about the easements in the acequias in Spain at that time. So they go way back, you know. And people that come from Texas or California or Newark or some place where they don't have acequias, they think that because they buy a piece of property and an acequia also runs through their property that they automatically have water rights. Well, they don't have water rights if they're not parciantes, if they're not due-paying members. The acequias come from way up above and go way below, sometimes land that they irrigate. But you cannot move the course of the acequia also unless everybody is in agreement. But some people they like a place where the acequias, I know in places there in Taos, in Colonias, where people have moved the acequias from there because they want to build a house where the acequia is situated. And that's where commissioners and mayordomos have not had the cajones to tell them, you can't do this. They allow them because they're afraid of them, because they're lawyers or they're doctors or they're educated people and they're afraid. And they say, well, they have money, you know, and we don't have money to defend our rights, you know. So that's why there's a lot of changes in the acequias, you know. And if we don't do something about it, we're going to lose our water rights. First, because we're not using it. Very few people are actually using it to grow food. I'd be surprised if 2% of the land is being used to raise food. A lot of the people that have land are using it now for growing hay or pasture, but in terms of growing gardens or that, if 2% are growing, that's a lot, you know. Because people are working now and they don't have the time, or if they plant a very small garden, maybe a 10 by 10 garden, and they call themselves organic gardeners. And, you know, and that's another thing that people here have always been organic growers. But that was not a concept that we needed, because we never, you know, my mother never used any pesticides. Or if she did, she was very minimal and maybe on some squash plants to kill the bugs, maybe once a year and a couple of teaspoons. And that would be about all, you know. But so the land here has never really been full of este sites in not even the orchards. Very few people use also pesticides for spraying their fruit trees. So when people from the outside come and say, well, you people are not organic, you know, well, they don't even know what they're talking about, because we have always been organic. The people here have always been sustainable people. They have lived off the land. They have always followed the principles of permaculture, because permaculture simply means permanent agriculture and or permanent culture. And so when people from the outside that have never been farmers and have never worked the land come and try to preach to us about permaculture, about sustainable agriculture and organic farming, instead of making allies with the local community, they turn the local community off, because they come here and they're very arrogant, you know. There's no dialogue and say, well, you know, how do you people plant? How do you do certain things? But they come here and say, well, this is what you should be doing, and this is what I learned because I booked this, I read this book on by so-and-so. And I think that's what the book that I did also is so important, because it proves that a lot of these concepts that are now new are old. They're 500 years old, and they're older, because what Gabriel Alonso de Herrera did was it gathered a lot of oral history interviews from the Moors there in Granada after they had been kicked out of Spain by the Christians in 1492. And since I found out several books on agriculture that were written by the Arabs as early as 975, I have a book there from 1075, another one from 1256, another one from 1348, from that school that's called La Escuela de Agronomía de Sevilla, that flourished between the 10th and the 14th century. And those books have a lot more varieties of vegetables included there than you would find today in any of the seed catalogs. We have lost a lot of the varieties, you know, a lot of the diversification. So for me, it's an insult when people come and tell me, you know, or I hear them tell the people from here, well, you don't know anything about agriculture because, you know, well, we've been doing it for hundreds, for thousands of years, you know, the same as the acequias, you know, they originated in the Pakistan, Afghanistan area. From there, they went to Mesopotamia, all through to Morocco, across to the Iberian Peninsula, into Mesoamerica, and up to where we live now in northern New Mexico. No? So we have thousands of years of experience of working with acequias and of working with these crops. Then that's what I'm been dedicating my life the past 20 years. You know, the Arabs had a concept of private experimental stations that they called almunias. Today we have experimental stations, but they are run by the universities, like the one in Alcalde, and they're doing an excellent job there. That's run by New Mexico State University. But under the Moors, they had these private experimental stations where people would experiment with the new crops and new cultivars that were being brought over from northern Africa and from the Orient along the Silk Road and see if they could acclimatize in Cordoba, in Sevilla, in Granada. And once they acclimatized there, well, then they were moved across the ocean to Mexico. And, you know, there's... And that's what I'm trying to do with my 2.5 acres that I have here. I'm trying to grow different crops of... right now, I'm working with a group of other people interested in fruits, you know, and there we got some scoine wood and from the UC Davis that they brought from Afghanistan and Pakistan, and Iran of apricots. We grafted about 40 different varieties of apricots at Gordon Tully's about 3 weeks ago. And we're going to be planting them throughout New Mexico to see how they do, if they grow, if they produce. We also have about 75 varieties of grapes that came from the same region that we're going to be planting also in different parts of New Mexico and see how they produce here. Because I think what we have to do is create more diversity, not less diversity, you know. And at the same time, trying to save the few seeds that are left. That's another thing that has rapidly disappeared in the past 30 years. You know, like my mom, she always used to have her own seeds of corn, chili, and different vegetables that she would plant. Now, all of us, including myself, have very little seeds. You know, we usually have to go out and buy them. The same thing as trees, you know, instead of creating our own trees, we go out and buy them. And there's a lot of old fruit varieties still available in northern New Mexico that we're trying to also graft into new rootstock and save before they're cut. And because we also have to realize that fruit trees, like humans, are not here forever. They die, you know, they maybe survive or produce for 75 years, 80 years at the most, and they're going to, like us, they're going to disappear. So what we can do, we cannot keep those orchards alive forever. But what we can do is save the wood, graft them into new rootstock, and create new trees. And that way we can preserve the same as we live in our kids and grandkids. Well, the same thing with the trees and the different seeds. You know, we have to plant them, grow them out, save seeds, grow them again, and same, you know, with everything that we do. And with the acequias, or the way we look at the land also, you know, we can't say, well, that's how it's always been done, and we have to do the same thing. Because one of the things that we're seeing now is that there's not a labor force available anymore. Before, there were plenty of kids in the communities that could be hired, or they would just go because their fathers owned the land and they would be the ones that would clean the acequias. Now there's no youth in the community. Most of the communities, the demographics have changed drastically, and what we're seeing are nothing but old people. So we have to find other ways of keeping the acequias alive. If that means using machinery, we have to use machinery, you know. And people sometimes, especially the newcomers, are against using machinery to clean the acequias. Well, who's going to clean them? They're not going to clean them. They're too old. I'm not going to go and clean the acequia because I can't either, you know. And I don't have kids that will be here to clean the acequias either. So, you know. And that's one thing about agriculturalists, I think, by farmers, is that we're very innovative and we're adaptable. You know, we can't always say, no, we're going to just stay the same way we were for 100, for 200. You know, the systems might be the same or the same concepts, but we're always finding ways of improving. You know, if there's ways of improving a fruit, of improving a crop, we want to do it. You know, you don't want to spend all your summer growing a corn that only grows that big, because that's the way it's been grown before, you know. And that's what some of the things that also Don Juan de Oñate did when he brought in new seeds, he introduced new seeds here, and the pueblos were appreciative of them, you know, that they were able to grow different corns, different beans, different squash, what today we call the Mexican squash. That was a squash that came from Mesoamerica, you know, that was bigger and better than what was being grown here in the Española Valley at that time. So I think agriculture is something about continuous growth, continuous experimentation, failure, experimentation, success, trying again, you know. And it's a cycle, you know. You can't say, no, we're not going to change anything, we're not going to get any new crops, or I'm not going to test any new varieties of apples, or no. And then it's better not to be a farmer, you know. And that's what I like about being able to graft, being able to grow different seedlings, you know, being able to improve what you have, being able to... this guy that I met at the Taos Organic Conference 2 weeks ago, he had gotten some seeds from a pear that his girlfriend is from China. And her parents had sent her some pears, and they were able to grow some, plant some other seeds and grow some seedlings. And so he brought me 5 seedlings that I have in the greenhouse now. Eventually I'll be transplanting them outside. And then he gave me the name of the pear, and I was checking on the internet for that pear. Well, last year was the first time that they brought some of that pear to some of the stores here in the U.S., and they only brought it to New York and L.A. So that's not a pear that's even available, or that you could buy the trees and plant them here. But I have Oriental pears. I have about 6 or 7 varieties of Oriental pears. I have a black apricot that's from Russia. I have jujubes that are native from Asia, but were also grown in Spain that I'm aware of. I'm the only one here in northern New Mexico that has jujubes. I have medlars. So I'm always trying new different crops. You know, I have that apricot that looks like the peach that looks like a donut. It's also a Chinese variety that's recently introduced into America. So I'm always looking for new varieties. I just found a pomegranate that will grow here. I even found a banana that will grow here. Really? And some figs that I'm going to be sending for them. And to me, that's the beauty of farming, experimentation, trying out new varieties of fruits. You know, I've taken some of my Asian pears to the farmer's market. Nobody buys them because people are, if they're not familiar with something, if they don't know it, they won't try it. And once they try it, they like it, you know. But when they see it there, they say, well, what's this, you know? I've never seen this type of fruit. Well, bite into it and see if you like it, you know. But for them to just go there, and it's both the Anglo and the Indo-Hispano community, none of them try them out, you know. There's very few people that are that adventurous. And I think, for me, agriculturalists are the most adventurous people and the biggest gamblers, because we're always gambling. You plant, you don't know if you're going to get a hailstorm, you're going to get flood, you're going to get frost, or an early freeze in the fall. And you're going to lose everything that you spent all summer long working on, and that you spend money buying seeds or whatever, you know. So for me, that's what it is, you know. It's about experimentation and about gambling. I would never go to a casino, but I gamble with what I plant here every day. Some of the fruits that I plant, I don't know if they're going to grow or if I'm just going to lose some money that I invested by, like now that I'm going to be sending for that pomegranate and that banana tree and fig tree. I don't know if they're going to grow, but they're supposed to, because they're hardy to zone 5. So I'm going to see how they do. And if they don't grow and I lose them, okay. Scratch them out or maybe try them again. You know, I've been trying to grow blueberries here. I've tried them for about 5 times and I haven't been able to grow them. And I haven't tried them for about 20 years, and I'm ready to try them again, you know. It's always that inkling to try something new, you know, not to remain with the same things that have been going on forever. And I think that the Pueblos proved that, you know. If they would have said, no, we're going to reject totally what the new settlers are bringing in, we're just going to stick to what we have, they probably wouldn't have survived. Because that's why the Anasazis had to keep on moving. You know, once you become a farmer and you're settled in an area, well, the chances are that you will survive because you've tried different strategies of growing food and different seeds that adapt. Others don't adapt. Others adapt and cross over, cross-pollinate, and you get a new cultivar and a new variety of vegetable, a new variety of fruit that's acclimatized to the area and that affords you the luxury of staying in the same place. And for me, that's part of agriculture and of utilizing the land and the space, and that's part of the memory that's all ingrained, the same as we have a certain memory of who we are, where we come from, where our ancestors came from. Well, the landscape has the same thing, you know. It's only finding that memory, being able to tap